It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions 18+. Slate's Double X Gab Fest is sponsored by Ring, the video doorbell that allows you to see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. Put your mind at ease and protect your home with Ring Video Doorbell. Get $10 off when you go to ring.com/XX. That's ring.com/XX. And by Harry's, the shaving company that offers German-engineered blades, well-designed handles, and shipping right to your door. Visit harrys.com for $5 off your first purchase with the promo code XX. That's DOUBLEX.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, August 6th, the fun, fearless female edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer for Slate and the Atlantic. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Laura Anderson, an editor and writer at Slate. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Hannah.
So, before we get going today, I have a couple of important announcements. Our next show is going to be a call-in show, which means we want you to call in and leave us a voicemail. We will likely play that voicemail on the air and then answer your question. It can be any kind of question, a high-minded question about feminism, a question about your own life, which are the ones that we like best. And here's the number that you should call and leave a message. 414-982-5590. I am informed by our producer, the lovely Anne, that that spells out 414-9-TALK-90. Do I sound like a morning radio person? I don't. I don't quite have the pep of that, like, hey, call in at 414-9-TALK-90. But anyway, that's my first announcement. The second one is that we are having a live show in D.C. Monday, September 21st. So come out and buy tickets. It's part of the Women's Voices Theater Festival at Woolly Mammoth Theater, which is my hands-down favorite theater in Washington, D.C. You can get tickets at www.slate.com/DCXX, spelled out DCDOUBLEX. So D.C. friends and friends in the region, please come and join us. We would love to see and meet you. Okay, let's start with our three topics. First, some retailers have decided to place Cosmo behind blinders to protect minors. Does Cosmo actually harm minors, as the activists say? And if so, exactly how? Second, Warren Buffett has been secretly funding a birth control revolution. What do we think about that? And third, the second installment in the XX Feminist Movie Club, we are going to talk about Thelma and Louise. Okay. So let's go on to our first topic. Cosmo, Rite Aid, and Food Lion have decided to place Cosmo behind a U-shaped cover binder that doesn't obscure the model but does obscure the headlines, such as sex so hot you'll need to crank the AC, and oh my goodness, the sex move he will worship you for. Do you guys know what that sex move is? Because I do.
You know, I read the magazine and I still don't know what it is.
Is it something where you like use an ice cube to like titillate your man and then, I don't know, perform oral sex on him?
I think it's actually like you stand on an altar and you pretend to be the Buddha and then he actually has to worship you. No, I'm not sure.
Sacrilegious.
So we decided to look at the magazine and judge for ourselves what kind of harm it actually does. So I will start. Who wants to describe the campaign? The campaign is pretty straightforward. The most interesting thing about it, though, is who is leading it, right?
Yes, it's Victoria Hearst, who's Patty Hearst's sister. I'm obsessed with Patty Hearst. I read a book about Patty Hearst every single year, so that gave me a little bit of a thrill. She's also the granddaughter of William Randolph Hearst.
And did you read her background? Like how she converted to Christianity?
Yeah.
She's been trying this one on Cosmo for a long time.
Right.
Apparently.
And you know, it's funny because to me, it brings up all kinds of memories about the porn wars of the 80s, because I recognize these talking points, you know, with a little bit of, as is so common these days, the language of kind of academic feminism. Like one of the things that she said is Cosmo is actually just a porn magazine glamorizing and legitimizing a dangerous lifestyle, pushing readers to try violent group or anal sex. Like not in the magazine that I read, but okay.
Right, but it is like it is that sort of anti-porn feminist language of the era that she, you know, kind of went to college in, I guess,
yeah.
translated through evangelical Christianity,
right.
which is what she became later, which
right.
is really pretty interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what did you guys think about that? Laura, did you ever read Cosmo? Did you read it when you were a teenager, since you're closer to being a teenager than the two of us?
I did read it when I was a teenager. I started reading it probably when I was 11 or 12, and I distinctly remember my parents arguing about whether it was appropriate for someone so young to be reading something so sexualized.
Really? Where did you get it when you were 11 or 12? Did you ask your mom to buy it for you?
Yeah, like we went to Barnes & Noble and, you know, in addition to books, I would ask to buy Cosmo and she would let me. I think the ultimate
was like
conclusion
Pride
was
and
that.
Prejudice.
The ultimate conclusion was that it was okay. But yeah, the concern I think was that there's a lot of explicit sex stuff in Cosmo, which is true. And this is obviously the concern of the people who want to cover it up at Rite Aid and Food Lion. But that is, in my opinion, the totally wrong concern because, like, teenagers and adolescents want to know explicit sex stuff. They want to know how sex works. They want to know, you know, what they will be doing when they eventually have sex. And so Cosmo is actually a pretty good resource for that. It's pretty, I mean, obviously, looking at it as an adult, you think, okay, some of these positions are totally ridiculous and no one would ever do them. But when you're a teenager, it like kind of gives you some information and some of the, like, I guess some of the titillation that you are looking for. I mean, the part of Cosmo that I thought was perhaps more harmful to me is the idea that you have to be really sexy in order to be a successful woman, and like the fact that it centers men in the discussions of sex, like how, you know, it's always like blow your man's mind instead of being like, okay, this is how you have mutually pleasurable sex that you communicate about and both enjoy. And so I think the idea that like you have to be very pleasing to a man, both in how you look and in how you act and in how you have sex with him, is maybe the more harmful part rather than the explicit stuff about, you know, blowjobs and anal sex.
You know, I have to say, I was surprised by how little of that there was, though. I mean, I remember that from looking at Cosmo in the past, many years in the past. Cosmo isn't something that's really on my, you know, in my media diet. But when I looked at it, you know, for our discussion, like other Hearst magazines, which I do read more actively, there is a lot of really pretty earnest, like, political content. You know, there was a little feature about the, you know, state's attorney in Baltimore who was so key in the Freddie Gray case.
Marilyn Mosby, yeah.
Yeah, and there was also, you know, there were maybe five stories about sex in, what, out of maybe 30. Like, there's not that much sex in there, and yet clearly that's their brand. And so they're going to keep putting those sex lines on the cover, but I don't know that it's really actually reflective of what's in the magazine anymore.
It's a little bit of a bait and switch. And I think since Joanna Coles has taken over the magazine as editor-in-chief, there's been much commentary on how it's become a lot more politically oriented and a little bit more serious and less single-mindedly focused on sex.
So when I read a magazine, I try to imagine the magazine as a person and who is the person that this magazine is trying to create or idealize. And one thing that I really don't like about women's magazines is, so this magazine starts with Helen Gurley Brown. It has like a long feminist history. And she was, as you said, Laura, really interested in the sexy woman who was also the career woman. And that's basically carried on. You know, you have a lot of talk here on like what you should wear to your first interview and also how to master the hand job. So then you bring it forward and that, like, the political direction doesn't seem to me like the direction to go. Like, it feels schizophrenic. And, like, why would you – I mean, I admire that there's a profile of the attorney general, but why? Like, I feel like what's the sensibility? Who is the person who would both be interested in that and then have this – like, what my least favorite story is the story I slept with a male model and here's what I learned. Did you guys read that story?
I did, yes.
Oh, my God. That was the worst thing. Like, the sex stuff I actually thought was pretty good. I'm with you, Laura. Like, I don't know why the man has to be at the center of it all the time. But, like, it is actually quite useful. Like, it actually tells you how to do stuff that you're probably, like, curious about and not sure how to do. And, you know, use lube every time. It's, like, really, really straightforward and explicit.
Just to be clear, that's use lube every time you're in a hand job, not every time you have sex.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. All right.
Just to be clear, I don't want to. I don't want to give the impression that Cosmo is not giving good sex advice.
Right. Well, I think like underneath all the frills and ridiculous tricks where you put a donut over your boyfriend's penis, there's a lot of just very basic advice that I think most sexual health practitioners would endorse. Like, they're really not going out there and saying, okay, you should have group sex. That is a wild exaggeration of the kind of advice that Cosmo gives.
But then, okay, I need to go back to this story because it really depressed me. When I was thinking, like, what would I want my daughter, like, I have a daughter who's the same, a little older than you were when you picked up Cosmo. So I was thinking of it in those terms. She doesn't read Cosmo, but she could pick it up one day or be interested in it. The sex advice, like, that would be all right, I think. But the man at the center of it tone is really not all right. Like this story, I would be horrified if she thought that this was within the realm of normal behavior. You know, this is a woman who says, like, he was a 10 and he's like a male model and I'm just a 6. Well, and I thought it was going to up my self-esteem if I went out with this guy. And then he's like an unbelievable asshole from the first instant of the date, and it takes her like all night to realize that. And at the end, she's like, I realize that, you know, for my own self-esteem, I don't need this male model. And I'm thinking, really? Like, you didn't know that from the first 3 seconds of the date, that you should get the hell away from this jerk? Anyway, I just don't want her to think that that's cool.
I don't know. I think that maybe I am now changing how I really experienced things, you know, when I was in my teens. But I remember in my case, the magazine that I read for, you know, this to satisfy my curiosity about sex was Jackie, which was, you know, a magazine that, you know, the newsagent would deliver every Wednesday. It didn't have the sort of porny sort of air of Cosmo, which I would say is really not justified anymore. It was a teenage magazine, but everybody knew that we were all getting it for the sex advice. But all of the stories, all of the personal stories were bullshit. And even as an 11-year-old, I knew that. And I don't think that anybody would really think, just like, you know, letters to Penthouse Forum or something, this thing about, you know, I had a male model, I'm a New York 6 of 7 in Ohio. I mean, I think it's just a parable. I don't think anybody takes that as this is what happened.
Oh, I love that. That actually is very helpful. So it's like a modern, it's like the way parables work nowadays, because it is written in this weirdly sort of straightforward kind of depersonalized tone. Like, it does not feel like a specific person wrote it. It just feels like generic girl wrote it. So Laura, do you think, I love Joanna Coles, like, just as a person in the world, you know, she goes on TV a lot. She's like, she's, you know, sort of a Tina Brownish. She's incredibly straightforward and intellectual and interesting and edgy, and I just love her. How do you think Cosmo has been influenced by, say, like Jezebel and the internet in general?
I think it's been a huge influence. I mean, Cosmo recently hired Jill Filipovich, formerly of Feministing, who is now writes for the website. So it's taken a very strong feminist bent, which I think it absolutely would not have done absent all the sort of feminist blogs that began to crop up in the middle of the 2000s. And, you know, is it a good fit? I don't know. I mean, do we need every single woman's magazine to be a feminist, or at least kind of like to present feminism and to perform feminism? I don't know if we do. And it does seem like you were saying before, it's a little bit of, you know, you get whiplash reading Cosmo, going back and forth between the serious stuff that about, you know, how abortion rights are being quashed in different parts of the world, and the stuff about blowjobs. And maybe we really only need Cosmo to be about blowjobs. But I don't know. I don't have any information on like how Cosmo has been selling since it started taking this more feminist bent. Maybe it's doing better.
But why earnest feminist? Like, can't you, the person who is interested in how to properly do a blowjob is interested in the world, but wouldn't the challenge be to figure out how is that person interested in the world? Like, how do they bring their sensibility and overlay it onto politics? It's not necessarily in a kind of earnest feminist, yay, rah, rah, go women, which actually seems more appropriate to Glamour magazine for me. Like, Cosmo, I haven't quite figured this out, but like, what would be the exact badass way that Cosmo girl would, eat up the political scene. Like, how about, what was that woman's name who ran for Congress? Crystal Ball?
Oh, yeah.
You know, there would be, that's a good campaign for Cosmo. You know, quit this idea that people have to have perfect lives if they are going to run for political office, because we've all been to parties and there will be pictures of us, and that doesn't mean that we're not qualified for public office. Like, there, how about that? That's a great Cosmo campaign. That makes sense.
Right. I mean, I think, though, that, I mean, as you know better than any of us, magazines are business entities. And so, you know, I agree with you completely that Cosmo, if she were a person, would be a very confusing person. At the same time, though, it's actually a magazine put out by the Hearst Corporation, along with several other magazines that aren't that dissimilar. There's not that many differences between them, except the thing that they're known for. And Cosmo is not that different from Marie Claire, except that it has some relatively explicit sex stories. So if you are the kind of person who is interested in learning more about how to do a really good hand job, then you would get Cosmo instead of one of the other magazines that are available directed toward women. So it doesn't, like, I don't think, especially these days when there are so many ways of taking in content, that it's fair to expect a internally consistent point of view.
I have one more proposal to throw out to you guys about Cosmo, and then we'll move to our next topic. The one thing I thought is, if I think of the difference between the men's magazines and the women's magazines, you know, like Maxim, you know, the men's magazines that talk about sex and are all sexed up, why can't Cosmo put a man on the cover? That would feel better to me, because then it's like, we are, you know, the male gaze that you guys talked about last on the last show. Like, that would feel feminist. Like, one or two times, like, you know, since we're going to watch Thelma and Louise, like the young Brad Pitt, like some dude like that, you know, like totally objectify some guy on the cover the way the men's magazines do.
You know what? I mean, that is a very weird thing. Like, I'm sure they've tried it in the past, and it clearly doesn't sell magazines. I mean, these days, and especially in the thing that we're talking about, you know, we're talking about the cover lines needing to be covered up, which probably drives people to buy it, thinking that it's way more sexy than it is. But I guess putting men on women's magazines doesn't sell copies. I mean, that just seems to be the only conclusion to draw from that.
And Cosmo prides itself so much on this quintessential fun, fearless female, is the very awkward phrase that they use to describe the ideal Cosmo girl or woman. So basically every cover model has to be an archetype of the fun, fearless female. And also, you know, they exist in part to sell makeup and clothing, and you could do that better if you have a woman on your cover than a man.
Okay, let's move on to our next topic, the birth control revolution. But before, we want to hear from our first sponsor. Ring!
Bing bong!
that was like a mid-century theater. I want to do that every time.
I'm going to do it again, even though Anne has it on a tip. Bing bong.
Hello there, June. Sorry. I can't help
it. I'm just going to keep bing bong. Bing bong. This is the sound of a package being delivered, or friends coming over to dinner, or all kinds of fun things. But it could also be someone trying to see if you're home so that they could rob you. Over 95% of home break-ins happen during the day, and burglars almost always stop by ringing the doorbell to see if someone's home. With the Ring video doorbell, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world. No kidding, using your smartphone. Ring's advanced motion detection alerts you even if someone doesn't ring the doorbell. It's like caller ID for your home. You know, I live in an apartment building, and I'm very aware of people opening the door for no good reason, and it is a big security risk. So the Ring video doorbell would avoid that instantly. Installing Ring takes minutes, and it works with either your current wiring or built-in rechargeable batteries. Put your mind at ease and protect your home with the video doorbell Time magazine named one of the top 10 gadgets of 2014. Right now, XX listeners get $10 off the Ring video doorbell when they go to ring.com/XX. That's ring.com/DOUBLEX. Protect your home and have peace of mind with Ring. Go to ring.com/XX for $10 off. That's ring.com/XX.
All right. I would like to say to all the robbers out there, I never lock my door, so don't bother to ring, and then I won't get the alert on ring.com because I always forget. Okay, let's move on to our next topic, birth control. So it turns out that while we were sleeping, a birth control revolution was happening, and it also turns out that it was secretly funded by Warren Buffett's foundation. I find the story so interesting and kind of inspiring. So first, they provided thousands of women free IUDs in Colorado. Then they made it possible by giving money to a company to develop a much cheaper alternative, because it turns out IUDs are expensive. And this has all been happening while we didn't really know, and we didn't know who was doing it. And part of the reason I love this story is because the stories are so negative generally in this realm, right? It's always like, everyone fighting to take away our birth control and our reproductive options. And then it turns out we have an ally on the other side of the fight, and he is incredibly powerful. Did you guys know about this?
I did not. No, not at all. And I find it fascinating that I feel like I, as a consumer, have heard so much more about IUDs over the past 10 years than I ever had before, and like heard more and more from feminist blogs and from magazines. And to a large extent, the research that went on behind that was funded by the Buffett Foundation, which is just sort of crazy.
Yeah. I hadn't heard about it either, no.
Yeah. And do you guys have a sense of why Warren Buffett? I mean, the fact that he suddenly popped up as the deus ex machina in this story is very interesting to me. He's so rich. He's so powerful. He's essentially 1950s Republican, I guess would be like a centrist Democrat now. And, you know, and he's got a wife who's very interested, or had a wife. She died recently, who's very interested in reproductive rights. But he's put in tons of money in this incredibly intelligent, targeted sort of Gates Foundation-ish way. Like, first they did the study showing that people prefer IUDs. That was really interesting. And then they funded IUDs and gave them to lots of people. Because I have a friend who's an inner city doctor who says, like, there's a huge suspicion of IUDs that is still pretty strong now. Like, people come into the office and they are suspicious of the doctor putting that IUD up in their body. I have an IUD and I love my IUD, I will say. I cannot understand why people are not all over the IUD, but there's just kind of a general suspicion of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the problem of them really expensive, so then they fix that problem. You know, it's like really while we were sleeping, like somebody was systematically trying to solve this problem, which is fabulous.
Well, it seems like a whole lot of the sort of credit for this goes to his late first wife, Susan Thompson Buffett, who was clearly a very interesting woman and who was committed to both reproductive rights and world peace. She seemed like they also put a lot of money into what, nuclear disarmament or some other similar sort of campaign. So not things that we typically associate with, as you say, like 1950s Republicans, but I think it also says more about our image of Warren Buffett, or guys, what we assume Warren Buffett to be like. You know, he's a guy from Omaha. And so we imagine, you know, we just make assumptions about him. And actually, it seems that, you know, he and his wife had an unusual, his first wife, who, as you say, she's now deceased, had an unusual, atypical arrangement. They had a daughter, then they lived in different cities. She kind of, it seems, set him up with his longtime companion, who is now his second wife. She seems like a really super cool woman, and I would love to know more about her. The parts of the story in Bloomberg Businessweek that are about her are, I just wanted more and more, although, of course, everything is a little bit surrounded in mystery.
Yeah, I mean, the donations remain anonymous. It's not entirely clear why. I mean, I know it's because you don't want evangelical groups to start boycotting. I mean, we're back to our Cosmo story, right? Like, this is not clean territory to be operating in. So it could be just straightforwardly that. I had this thought that I really should not say on a podcast, that, you know, they're 1940s and 50s conservatives, and this is not Warren Buffett at all, nor should it be part of this history. So please bracket this. They were, I know this because my husband wrote a book about eugenics, they were kind of interested in birth control for the wrong reasons. Mm. You know, it was like, keep the poor from having babies and let everybody else have babies. And so there was a lot of interest in those decades in birth control. I'm not saying at all that's why Warren Buffett is interested in it, because in fact, it's now the left, you see this a lot in left sociology writing about LARCs, which are long-acting reversible contraceptives, as the solution to our single mother problem, you know. So the right will say, you know, make people get married, bring back marriage, 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 marriage. And the left is now saying, particularly by a great book by Isabel Sawhill, saying, no, the answer is give people more control over when they have children so that they can have children when they're ready to have children. And people are coalescing around things like IUDs as the answer. So it all kind of comes full circle. It's a much, much, if it works, it's like a bigger social revolution and solves more problems than we realize.
There is some discussion in the Business Week article about programs in which women are actually paid to get IUDs, low-income women, and that which definitely harkens back to the sort of gross eugenics style mm-hmm. programs of the past, and it seems like you can actually draw a pretty clear line here that giving women IUDs for free is great and it gives them control over how they want to manage their fertility, and paying them to get IUDs is coercive and gross, and we shouldn't do that. Like, I don't know. I thought that part was interesting, and the idea that anyone thinks it's a good idea to pay women to not have kids is just problematic.
So paying them is problematic, but what about, you know, what this company did, which was reduce the price from $800 to $50, like have a generic brand IUD that costs a lot less money, the low-cost IUD, they're calling it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is a total game changer and is amazing.
And it's also interesting that they make it available, you know, at a more sort of commercial cost for people who have insurance. And then the $50 is the cost to clinics. And that, to me, is, again, I'm clearly just going by my image of people like Warren Buffett, but that feels very sort of, in cold economic terms, that's smart. It's both sort of humane and it seems like good economics that's maybe not about making a profit for a company. But yeah, that's a really good thing to do.
Yeah, and I will say this is the results of the Warren Buffett funded campaign. It was so what he did was provide private funding to 28 clinics to offer LARCs. I hate that term. It's such a clinical term. Let's say birth control.
I like it. It sounds like a bird.
LARCs.
Going on a lark, man.
It is, because, you know, it's like your life can take flight. You know, you take the lark and then you become the lark.
Exactly.
You're not burdened. At little or no cost to women, reduced births to high risk, mostly poor young women ages 15 to 24 by 27% over the 2 years. That's huge. That is a hugely successful program. Now we get into the problems, which is that, you know, because it's Warren Buffett, he did not want this to be perpetuated by private funding. And so then the Colorado legislature declined to fund it.
Yeah, and that's really concerning because in Colorado, teen pregnancies dropped 39%. The teen abortion rate dropped 42% over the 5 years that, you know, the Colorado Family Planning Initiative was in place. And then the Colorado legislatures said, well, if private funding is available, why would we use public funding? And that is A, maddening, but B, you can kind of see, you know, the right is forever talking about building dependencies. Now, they're always talking about, you know, whatever their current bête noire is, but they are kind of becoming welfare queens and making air quotes themselves by only wanting to use private funding that they feel now they deserve because they've become dependent on it. It's enraging to me.
It is. And it's like the politics of this have all come full circle. Like, you could see that maybe conservatives, who used to be more of the elite centrist Republican, you know, we must control the birth rates among poor people, are now in the totally opposite place where, you know, they're, you know, anti-abortion, anti any kinds of birth control. Like, if children come, let the children come. They're on the other side. I wonder if it's partly because they're haunted by the eugenicist past. It's partly just the power of the pro-life movement. But it seems to me like actually a more interesting fight than the one we've been having about abortion and birth control, where the left has something new to say and new stakes and new incredibly solid research to back up their position, and also like a pretty graspable moral position. You know how the left has always been backing away with abortion and, like, you know, finding ever new terms to say, like, we're really concerned about abortion, but we still think we should allow it. Now they have something very moral to say, which is let poor women get their lives in order and then women have children. It's like a much more compelling moral stance than we've had in a long time.
I totally agree with everything you just said, Hannah. But I think that the position on the right, the reason they're constrained is because they are just afraid to touch anything about sexuality and teen sexuality in particular with a 10-foot pole. I forget which article I read this in, but in discussions in Colorado about whether to continue funding this program, you know, the Republicans were saying things like, well, we don't want to encourage teens to have sex. We're afraid that stuff like this is encouraging teens to be sexual before they're ready, that kind of thing. And like, I just think if you expect bipartisanship on this issue, I just don't know if you're going to get it because the Republican Party is just so overwhelmingly in the thrall of fundamentalist Christians who believe that any kind of premarital sex is immoral and should not be encouraged in any way by the government.
Okay. Let's move on to our third topic, which is Thelma and Louise. But before we do that, we would like to thank our next sponsor, Harry's. I can do this with gusto because I live in a fully converted Harry's household. These little orange razors dot my medicine cabinet. My husband shaves with them. He totally loves them. He says, in fact, he will never touch another razor again. It has changed his shaving life. It was started by two guys who decided that shaving was expensive, that blades were no good. And so they decided that they can make quality blades for cheaper. So they bought up a German factory because the Germans make everything better than everyone else. And they made this great razor. For $15 for the starter package, you get a razor, three blades, and shaving cream or gel. So go to harrys.com and Harry's will give you $5 off if you type in the promo code XX spelled out. That's DOUBLEX with your first purchase. Harrys.com, coupon code XX for $5 off the already very economical starter set. Let's move on to Thelma and Louise. Thelma and Louise, 1991 movie in which two friends, played by Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis, embark on either a disastrous or exhilarating road trip. That we've been debating for nearly 25 years. It still feels all these years later like a feminist classic, but what exactly was the moment in either cinematic or feminist history that it marked? First, I want to ask you guys if you saw it when it came out, or Laura, probably not when it came out, but if you've seen it before watching it for this segment.
I did not see when it came out because I was four. I did see it when I was a teenager and then rewatched it last night and was surprised by the things that I had forgotten because it's been like maybe 10 or 15 years since I'd seen it.
And yeah. I had not seen it before, although for many years I thought I had. I assumed I had. Because I do remember all of the fuss and all of the discussion, and I can't believe I didn't contribute to that. I don't know if I contributed without watching it. And
so do you want to do like a basic plot for our listeners in case they don't remember? Because I'm sure most people have seen it probably. I would imagine the overlap between XX podcast listeners and viewers of Thelma and Louise is high, but they might not remember the details.
Yeah. So Louise is a diner waitress in Arkansas. And she starts, the movie begins by her calling up her friend Thelma and seeing if she's ready to go on a weekend fishing trip with her. And they set off on this overnight trip. And then it turns out that on their first stop at a sort of roadhouse, Thelma gets to dancing with a dude who attempts to rape her in the parking lot and Louise kills him. And then they go on the run, essentially.
Yeah, then it's like Bonnie and Clyde, but it's Bonnie and Bonnie. They go on the run. Things keep happening. Some of the things are charming. Some of the things are terrible. They meet the young Brad Pitt. Seeing the young Brad Pitt is weird. Like, I'm so used to seeing him on the magazine covers surrounded by his 300 children.
The thing that surprised me the most about young Brad Pitt is how, like, sort of like smarmy and rat-like he was. He did not seem attractive to me at all in this movie, whereas I think when I watched it when I was a teenager, I thought he was hot. But
I was mostly noticing like how free he seems. You know, he's so encumbered now, and he was so unencumbered. Like he was literally just like a guy hitchhiking. He never seemed to have a place to stay or any clothing. He was like a drifter and a thief, you know?
Yeah, his performance was very good, I would say.
I thought everyone's performance was very good, but I'm going to tip my hand early because I just love this movie. It is just like deepened in meaning for me, but I think I probably love it more than most people. Laura, what did you notice this time around that you hadn't noticed when you were a teenager?
Well, okay. One thing is that Thelma and Louise discuss immediately after Thelma's rape that no one will believe them.
Louise, where are we going? I don't know. I don't know. Just shut up so I can think.
Shouldn't we go to the cops? I mean, I think we ought to tell the police.
Tell them what, Thelma? Just what do you think we should tell them, huh?
I don't know. Just tell them what happened.
Which part?
All of it. That he was raping me.
Just about 100 goddamn people saw you dancing cheek to cheek with him all night. Who's going to believe that? That we don't live in that kind of a world, Thelma. God damn it, pull over.
And that just struck me more as a really important plot point, because if they didn't believe that, then they wouldn't have gone on the run. And it just a very sort of like straightforward and true feminist talking point, kind of, that like, yeah, it's probably true. No one would believe them if they said that this guy had been raping Thelma.
Yeah, that seemed totally plausible to me, because she's such a like bubbly, fun-loving girl, and she was drinking a lot, and it was like they're in a bar somewhere in Arkansas, and she was dancing with him the whole night long, and she, you know, I felt like she was right that no one would believe her.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then I think the other thing that I just noticed more this time is the progression, like, you know, line of dominoes, just sort of like one thing leading to another, and then they just get in really deep shit. I think the only thing I remember from before is that, like, oh, they killed this guy who raped Thelma. But then they get robbed by Brad Pitt.
Where's the money? Oh my God, Thelma, where's the money?
Then Thelma has to rob a convenience store.
You robbed the store? The goddamn store? Well, we needed the money!
They imprison and kidnap this state trooper.
Well, step into the trunk, please.
Please. I have one of the kids, please.
You do? Well, you're lucky. You be sweet to them, especially your wife. My husband wasn't sweet to me. Look how I turned out.
And then they blow up the truck of this horrible lewd trucker who's been harassing them.
I don't think he's going to apologize.
Nah, I don't think so.
The progression and one thing leading to another, and the sort of the emotional valence of these things changing over time, from it being where they're basically entrapped and sort of like reacting to being more proactive in their own crime spree, that really struck me this time.
That struck me too. You know, exactly those two things. One, that the structure, I thought it was like a very well put together puzzle. Like, I thought the plot structure was actually quite great, and how simultaneously you deepen the sense of entrapment and oppression, and some patriarchal oppression, but some oppression caused by the fact that they're just in deep shit, and then the sense of liberation at the same time. And I wasn't exactly sure what the message was, and reading commentaries that have built up over the last 20 years, it seems like some people fall on the oppression side, some people fall on the liberation side. But those two things kind of build simultaneously in a way that I just found so great watching it again.
See, I have to say, I was a little disappointed with the film. But I think it's more about me and having kind of become a TV person. I used to go to so many movies. Now I very rarely watch movies. And there's just extended periods where nothing really is happening. And some of the dialogue felt excessively on the nose. And although there were many things that I enjoyed, like all the things that you've talked about, and then also the sort of female solidarity. You know, there's a scene, there's a cop who's played by Harvey Keitel, who's kind of, you know, chasing.
A good guy.
He's a good cop, and he's chasing them. And he asks the waitress at the Roadhouse, you know, if she thinks they did it.
Who do you think did it?
Has anybody asked his wife? She's the one I hope did it.
Lena, do you have any ideas, or don't you?
Well, if I had to guess, I'd say it was some old gal's husband. But it wasn't neither one of those two. The smaller one, the one with the tidy hairdo, she left me a huge tip.
Well.
What?
You didn't happen to notice what kind of car they were driving, did you?
It's a nightclub, Hal, not a drive-in. I don't follow the customers out to the parking lot.
Oh.
All right.
And to go on home.
Oh. Neither of those two was the murdering type, Hal.
You have a feeling, which is not clear. This is one of those, to me, pleasantly unclear and open for interpretation elements of, is she demonstrating female solidarity, or has she just been, she just think, oh, they're just girls and girls who tip well, so they're nice girls, You know, like, what is it? It's not clear to me. And I enjoyed that lack of clarity because other things just felt way too on the nose.
What were some of the on the nose lines? I agree with you. I was thinking very much about, would this movie be made now? Like, were there are certainly lines in the movie that would be too obvious to be spoken now because they're just like too feminist on the nose. Do you remember any of them, June? Because you have a good ear for dialogue.
Yeah, some of them I have to admit I made a note of just because they kind of made me wince a little bit. I mean, mostly it's about Thelma's transformation. And the reason that it annoyed me really was that it wasn't necessary. We can see that she's been transformed. We can see both in her appearance and in the way she was so confident at the stick-up, which, yes, she was committing a crime, but nevertheless, she was displaying, you know, she'd finally pulled herself together and found her inner power. Calling it, and she says things like, something's crossed over in me. I just can't go back. I feel awake, wide awake.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah. It's funny, I was mixed about those lines because I kind of appreciated the earnestness of the movie.
Yeah.
Like how just kind of openly it embraced the Riot Girl moment that it was being made in and its, you know, subversive quality in a very tender way, because that's the quality I feel a movie could not do now. Like there's definitely movies about how women have won the right to be just as crazy as men, and particularly like, you know, sexually raunchy, like Bridesmaids, those kinds of movies, but they would never talk about that inner female journey so openly the way this movie did, or just embrace the beauty of the sisterhood, you know, or the kind of delight in liberation. It just feels all of a feminist moment that we would be slightly a little embarrassed or too cynical or something to do right now.
Can I ask you both a question? I was confused at the beginning of the movie when it was set. Partly it's because of the car that Louise drives, which, you know, is a classic, I guess it's a T-Bird. I guess it's from 1956. I mean, it's not a contemporary car when the movie came out. But so the attitudes that the men evinced, although quite believable, would men really have acted quite that way in 1991 when the movie came out? And I couldn't tell, is it set in 1990 or is it set in 1970 or 1980? What did you guys think about that?
It is a really interesting question. I was thinking it actually visually, without being explicit, is suggesting a movement from the 50s to the 70s. Because in the beginning, Susan Sarandon's character is like, looks like a 50s throwback. She's driving that car and she's also wearing a handkerchief around her head. It's just like a retro moment.
And her waitress uniform is also quite retro.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then as time goes on, what happens? Like she lets her hair down, she throws her jewelry away. She's like going through a 60s revolution visually. I don't know. What did you think, Laura?
I think that's a great observation. And yeah, I also had the same sort of moment of confusion. And I guess looking at it, you know, you have to, and I think this is something Dana Stevens mentioned in her review a few years ago, is that their appearance is transformed throughout the course of the movie, and that is a form of their becoming more modern looking. It's funny to watch movies 20 years or 24 years after they've been made and to try to think about how people at the moment would have seen them. I wonder if we'd been watching this in 1991, would we have had that question at all?
So let's talk about the ending of the movie, because it's been much debated, and apparently Ridley Scott shot an alternative ending. The ending is incredibly famous, and I remember I was in college at the time just being really struck by the ending. I mean, I was surprised when I saw the movie. I just didn't know what to make of the ending. So what happens at the end is that they're being pursued by the cops, and at this point they're being pursued by federal officers, and Harvey Keitel, who's the local officer who's kind of put all the pieces together, including the piece that Susan Sarandon's character was once raped, and that's where her rage comes from. So he's like really the good guy, right? Yeah. Like he totally understands them. You go from her cartoon husband, Daryl, to this sort of Elvis Presley boyfriend of Louise, to Harvey Keitel, who's like the modern man who can really understand the woman, you know, and everything she's been through. He's like a secret feminist, Harvey Keitel. And then the bureaucrats come, who are the Washington bureaucrat types. And they come and they're like, blah, blah, blah. These are the rules. These guys are armed and dangerous, you know. So they send out the SWAT team who captures them at the end. I guess they're in Nevada at that point. Or no, where are they?
They're at the Grand Canyon.
And they are on the edge of the cliff and they are surrounded by cars. And then there's the moment. let's play that moment when Thelma and Louise essentially say goodbye to each other.
Okay, then, listen. Let's not get caught.
What are you talking about?
Let's keep going.
What do you mean?
Go!
You sure?
Yeah. Hit it.
Off the cliff. Oh my God, I'm such a sucker. I will get goosebumps every time I hear that cheesy music for the rest of my entire life, even if I watch that scene 400 times. Ugh. So, June, was that too on the nose, that dialogue they had in the car, that kind of sisterly goodbye?
No, I mean, that's an interesting part of the film for me, that after, I mean, because it seems like a lot of the on the nose stuff comes toward the end, and you're like, we get it. And then at the end, there is a sense of a lack of resolution that you can kind of write your own ending, if you like.
Okay, so the one last question I have about Thelma and Louise, this is a hard one. I was thinking, if you were to make a 2015 remake of Thelma and Louise, or of a girl power road trip, could you make it interesting? Is there anything you could do to like convey that sense of simultaneous liberation and oppression?
You could have them taking copies of Cosmo around the American Southwest.
Right, and distributing IUDs.
Yes.
And that everyone would go see that movie. Last person.
Everyone.
All right, that was a failure. But listeners, why don't you, because you're smarter than we are, go to our Facebook page and tell us if you can think of how a 2015 Girl Power road trip would look and be simultaneously dark and liberating. What would be the plot? Okay, well, let's move on to our recommendations. June, why don't you go first?
I want to recommend a book, but I have to, before I say its name, just kind of give a little background. This book is written by the spouse of a Slate writer, and I only mentioned that because that was why I happened to pick it up. The book that I'm talking about is Local Girls by Caroline Zancan. I very rarely pick up first novels, and I only did because I went to the book party, which had fantastic past apps, and I felt it was my polite duty to buy the book, and I fucking loved it. It's a really fantastic novel about people that are rarely written about. Essentially, three or four, depending how you count, 19-year-old girls in Florida who are smart and funny and love each other, but are not ambitious and are either realistic or pessimistic, depending on your point of view, about what can happen to them in life. And it's a very, you know, not a lot happens in the story, although it's very profound and very significant. And one of the key situations is that three of the girls find themselves in a diner, in my view, not unlike the one in Thelma and Louise, talking with a major Hollywood superstar and actually getting drunk with him. And it's just a wonderful book, and I highly recommend it. And it's called Local Girls by Caroline Zancan.
Sounds amazing. Laura, do you have a recommendation for us?
I do. There's a movie coming out this week called Ricky and the Flash, in which Meryl Streep stars as a would-be rock star.
Have you seen it?
I went to a screening earlier this week.
Oh, my God. I couldn't tell from the previews whether it was going to be like really awesome or really terrible.
That was exactly my question ahead of time. And I don't want to spoil anything. I thought, you know, I think Meryl Streep is always is fun to watch, especially when she's hamming it up and like singing, which she obviously really likes to do. And she just she throws herself into this role the way that she always does. So whether you see the movie, I think, will depend on how much you love Meryl Streep. But what I want to recommend is not the movie, but a song that was written for the movie by Jenny Lewis that Meryl Streep performs in it. It's called Cold One. And it's just a great song that's been stuck in my head ever since I saw the movie. And Meryl Streep's performance of it in the movie is very affecting. And you can find a clip online and we can link to it on our show page.
Okay, I'm going to recommend a new podcast that was actually recommended to me by XX alum Jess Gross. It's called You Must Remember This, and it's about classic Hollywood. It's by the great Carina Longworth, who is a film critic, and it's really great. It's doing a 10-part series about Charles Manson and Hollywood. She talks about Mia Farrow in the 60s, Raquel Welch, Howard Hughes. It's just really, really great for people who love old Hollywood, which I do, so you should totally check it out. Okay. Just a reminder, please call in this week and leave us your questions on our voicemail, and we will answer them on the next show. The number again is 414-982-5590 or 414-9-TALK-90. We welcome all questions. And then once again, our live show Monday, September 21st. Please buy tickets to that in D.C. Thanks to our producer, Ann Hepperman, our managing producer, Joel Meyer, Andy Bowers, the executive producer of Slate Podcasts, and our wonderful intern, Jesse Chasen-Tabor. The XX GabFest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/Panoply. You can get more information about this show on our show page, slate.com/XX. Please always visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, to tell us about the 2015 Roadshow Thelma and Louise edition, or just to leave us comments, questions, and suggestions for new topics. Our email is XXGabFest@slate.com, and subscribe on iTunes so other people can find out about the show. For Laura and June, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will speak to you again in 2 weeks.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.